Hello and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm producer Ammon Swenson, sitting in for our hosts. If you spend a lot of time listening to public radio, you've probably heard StoryCorps on NPR's Morning Edition. The organization gathers conversations from people of all types and archives them in the Library of Congress. The short stories can be sweet, funny, and heartbreaking. As part of their Military Voices initiative, StoryCorps partnered with us at Alaska Public Media to record veterans, active members of the armed forces, or their families to document their stories. While the virtual recording opportunities have closed, StoryCorps will be at the Anchorage Public Library July 24th through the 28th for in-person recordings. We'll have links for signups on the Hometown Alaska page. Coming up in this hour, we'll hear from the CEO of StoryCorps to find out more about the project, and we'll learn about the women's veteran organization, Operation Mary Louise. But first, let's take a listen to a Military Voices piece that was recorded and produced here in Alaska back in 2014. This is Jonathan Green.
Well, I guess it would really start on my birthday, January 13th, 1961, Friday. It was a thunderstorm and lightning storm that day. And when I was born with Poulin sequence, which affected my left hand. I have a thumb. I have a pinky and ring finger that are stuck together. And my left hand is like in a V shape. As I grew up, had to go through Shriners to have some surgeries done to make it more efficient. And as I got older and gone through high school, I always wanted to be in the military. So when I got out of high school, that was the first place I went to was the Air Force recruiter. And I sat down with him and told him what I wanted to do and what my ambitions were. And well, as soon as he saw my left hand, he told me that I could not join. And I asked him why. He said that I had to have the capability of shooting with both hands. But then I asked him, well, couldn't I be like a chauffeur for a colonel, a general, work in an office filing, work in the post office, you know, do something for the country? And he said, no, you still have to be able to shoot with both hands going through basic. And so I figured, well, if I can't go into the Air Force, I'll try the other three. So I went and talked to the Army, the Navy, and the Marines. And I swear that Air Force recruiter talked to the other three recruiters, and because they told me the same thing, I'd have to be able to shoot with both hands. So then it was like, okay, what am I going to do with my life? I wasn't 100% sure. Then I had an opportunity to come to Alaska in 86 and Sitka, Alaska, and work at the pulp mill, and that was really cool. And when I arrived in Alaska, I knew this is where I wanted to live. And while my 3.5 years in Sitka, I was a volunteer for State Parks and Recreation and interacting with the forest ranger there, I figured that, you know, I'm going to leave Sitka, I am going to go to college, and I'm going to become a forest ranger and learn a little bit about photography. I was working at Stewart's Photo here downtown Anchorage, and I met this one woman from the school district, and she talked me into teaching a photography class at Creekside Elementary School for the community school program. A friend of ours was looking for a job in the government for herself, and she came across an opening here on, at the time it was Ilmendorf, but a photography position. There was 4 positions open. I didn't think I had any chance at all to get one of the 4 positions, but I figured, what the hey, I might as well go ahead and do it. So I went through all the paperwork and whatnot, and to my surprise, I was 1 of 4 photographers hired to be a photographer on the new Joint Base Ilmendorf-Richardson. Yeah, I was pretty thrilled. I finally got my wish. I got to be in the Air Force and support my country. I think the military really has changed perception-wise. And I'm glad it has, because it's given me the opportunity to have the job that I have. And I love my job. I look forward to going to work every day. And the funny thing is that way back when the recruiter told me that I had to be able to shoot with both hands, well, that's what I was hired to do. So now I shoot with both hands, but I use a camera, not a weapon.
Up next, I'm joined by StoryCorps CEO Sandy Clark to find out more about the organization and the Military Voices Initiative.
Well, this is StoryCorps' 20th anniversary, if you can believe that. And for the last 20 years, we have been preserving and sharing humanity's stories, which means that, you know, we have a StoryCorps booth where folks can come in with somebody whose story they want to honor. They sit across from each other in the intimacy of our StoryCorps booth, and they share a story that they would want others to remember them by, right? And it is the ultimate act of love, not to just storytell, but also to listen, to take that time to, you know, really be with someone and to hear the story that they want to leave you with. And StoryCorps believes that by, you know, creating a place where folks can come together, whether it's virtually or in person, to tell their stories, that we are building connections with each other as human beings and in understandings. All of these stories, you listen to them and you go, I didn't know that, and I just learned something. And our hope is that through listening and sharing stories that we create a more just and compassionate world.
Yeah, and so what is the Military Voices Initiative and how did it originate?
So the Military Voices Initiative is an initiative where StoryCorps, you know, chooses a couple of cities a year where we go and we partner with, you know, local organizations and the public media stations to capture stories from our veterans and our service members, both active duty and retired, and their family members as well. You know, the origins of the Military Voices Initiative, it really started with, you know, a little bit of a sad story. So the general manager at WMUK in Kalamazoo, Michigan, Gordon Volar, you know, he really got very close to the StoryCorps mobile team when the tour went through Kalamazoo in 2007. But a few days after StoryCorps left town, his son, Army Specialist Matthew Bolar, was killed by an IED in Iraq. And so Gordon sent a note to the mobile team, and StoryCorps founder Dave Isay saw his note and reached out to him. And they became very close. And eventually, Military Voices was launched in 2012 with the support of CPB in memory of Matthew. You know, it was originally just it was a post 9/11 initiative. And after, you know, after that, we opened it up to active duty and families, and then expanded in 2017 to all U.S. conflicts. And the thing about, you know, the Military Voices Initiative is that, You know, I grew up as a military kid, and my dad was in the Army for 30 years. When you grow up in kind of a military family, you think everyone's in the military. You actually have no sense of, like, you know, that there's a select, small, really, percentage of people who sign up for military service. And, you know, growing up, I thought it was so normal. But now looking back on it, you know, there aren't that many people who really sign up to be in the military and sacrifice, take on that sacrifice. And so we at StoryCorps and with the support of CPB wanted a chance to document these stories and to give an opportunity for military folks to be able to share their stories.
Yeah, and I know you've kind of touched on this aspect and a little bit and whatnot, but, you know, why bother collecting and archiving all of this stuff?
Well, you know, these are our moments in history, for one. These are, you know, family legacies in many ways. And many service families, you know, it starts with one member and then another and another. In my own family, my sister also went into the military. So in part, it's a very personal thing of family members wanting to share their stories. But it's also, you know, tells the story of our nation. And these are stories that defy stereotype. They're stories that you would never, ever hear had it not been for efforts like this. You know, if we think about coverage of military families these days, you know, the extent of it is really, you know, Facebook videos where there's the surprise, you know, return of a service member. But the reality is there's very, very little coverage of what it's like to be in a military family and what that sacrifice really means.
Do you know about how many recordings have been done for Military Voices or maybe even StoryCorps in general?
Yeah, well, StoryCorps in general, we've had, you know, 600,000 participants, more than that, in the 20 years that we've been crossing the country and working in numerous partnerships. preserving and collecting stories. And in Military Voices since 2012, we've, you know, collected about 2,000, almost 2,000 stories people have come to share with us.
Well, you know, you mentioned that you came from a military family. Could you maybe share your story just a little bit about what your situation was?
Sure. So my dad, you know, he went into the military when he was 17 years old. He kind of lied about his age. Now I can tell you that because, you know, it won't matter. He served the country so nobly. But, you know, it was also, you know, he grew up very poor and he wanted to see the world. And so he ended up joining the military. And it took him to so many different places. And one of those was to Japan. And so my mother is Japanese. He met my mother when he was serving in Japan. And through about the fourth grade, we went back and forth to Japan. I was the only stateside baby. I was born in North Carolina, and my brother and two sisters were born in Japan. And my dad ultimately retired in Kansas, in Fort Riley, Kansas. So, you know, all we knew was military life and moving around. And I think, you know, in many ways, because we really didn't know what that was, it was just so normal to us every single day. You know, it also is the thing that was, you know, such a tremendous education for us. It was the thing that opened up the world to us in so many different ways as well.
Did your dad share stories of his service?
You know, he did a little bit. You know, I have to say that when I was growing up, there wasn't this kind of spirit out there of, you know, of really honoring service people in the way I think that we do now. He really, for him, it was kind of a private thing. He served in two tours in Vietnam. He was also in Korea. And so, you know, he talked about it a little bit, but in truth, not very much. And I really regret that there wasn't a Story Corps as I was growing up, because, you know, I would give anything to be able to hear his story, to hear his voice, and to have him tell it in his own words of what he experienced.
Yeah. I mean, what are the stories that you do have now mean to you, I guess?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I look through the stories that, you know, service people have shared, service members and their families have shared with Story Corps. And everyone is a different story. There's no one story that is the same, and they move you every single time for different reasons. And these are stories, you know, that really capture the full breadth of military service. They're not, you know, some of them are about trauma, some of them are about sacrifice, and others are about pride and joy and transformations because of military experience. So they really run the gamut. You know, when I look back on my dad and even my mom, you know, because I mean, as a military wife, she also, you know, had her own sacrifice as well. But I think my dad was a, you know, multiple Purple Heart recipient.
Wow.
And none of us knew what that meant when we were growing up. I mean, we had no clue what it meant to be a Purple Heart recipient. We didn't know why he wore his Purple Heart hat every day long after he retired. And in fact, you know, a little bit of a joke in our family was that, you know, we always try to get him to wear a different hat because we were just little kids growing, you know, we were just kids. And so it's like, don't you want a Nike hat, Dad? Don't you want an Adidas hat? And he always came back to his Purple Heart hat. And, you know, when he passed, my sisters and I were talking about that. And we, you know, and as we divided up his Purple Hearts, I think that was the moment when we really looked back and we thought like, oh my gosh, if we had a chance to tell him how proud we were of him, how sorry we were that we didn't understand his sacrifice. But, you know, we didn't have that chance. And so I think in many ways you come to appreciate things when you look back.
Yeah, totally. Well, you know, for people who might be interested in participating, can we maybe demystify the process a little bit? Like, what will it entail for somebody that's, you know, maybe interested, but maybe not quite committed yet?
Sure. Well, you know, you sign up, you know, to be able to do an interview. We have a Story Corps facilitators, and our facilitators are trained, you know, interestingly, they're trained to listen for the most part. They'll fact check a few things. They may ask, you know, somebody to explain something a little bit more. But really, they're just trying to get the most accurate record to be shared in the Library of Congress. If you get stuck and don't know quite what to say, then we have, you know, some questions that might be used to as prompts. But in reality, you know, people come into the StoryCorps booth. Sometimes they don't really know what they're going to talk about, but things just start spilling out. Because if we think about how much we see people or we live with people in our own families in many cases, and there are things that we just don't tell each other. And because we have so few opportunities to kind of have that very still moment when we're sitting across from each other, no distractions. And people very quickly realize how special it is to be able to have that experience. And suddenly one question, one piece of a conversation leads to something else. These are really, you know, 40-minute conversations. What you hear on NPR in our morning edition weekly segments is a long interview that's condensed into a short one. But, you know, what's archived is the entire conversation. If people choose, I mean, and the vast majority of participants want their stories to be archived so that, you know, generations from now, family members can come to know the person who is sharing their story through their own voice in their own way.
Yeah, and it sounds like if people are like, ooh, maybe I don't want that shared, they can still get a copy and have it for their own memorabilia.
Yes, that's right. And our number one principle is we honor the participants. And so participants get to say, oh, never mind, you know. And it's funny, one of the things that we found in our many, many years doing these interviews is that people reveal things, and way more often than not, they realize that they've shared something that maybe they weren't sure about. And then they go, you know what, but I want somebody to know that. And so, yeah. And it's entirely up to them whether the interview is archived, shared. I mean, there's also a way to, you know, to have a private setting on it in the archive. I mean, there's so many different ways to do that, but we certainly honor what the participants want.
So who are you hoping will participate? I mean, you know, active members, veterans, the family members, who are we thinking?
All of the above. You know, we don't tell people what story to tell us, and you know, whoever wants to sign up and, you know, wants to participate has an opportunity to do so. We'll be in person in Anchorage at the CJ Lusick Public Library from July 24th to 28th. And we have a few spots still available there. So, you know, if you're interested, then please sign up.
And I mean, it sounds like people shouldn't be concerned if they don't have a lot of like interview type experience. They should still maybe give it a shot.
Yeah, no, you know what? Join the almost other 600,000 people that StoryCorps has interviewed, because most people, in fact, almost all come in with no interview experience, no idea what they're walking into exactly until they get into that booth and they leave us with such beautiful stories and such wisdom.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of stories might be, you know, fairly mundane or just kind of everyday, but do you have guidance on maybe tougher subjects that might come up?
Yes. I mean, you know, I think it really is up to the participant, and the facilitators are there to help guide. And so, you know, and by the way, the mundane stuff, it may be mundane to some people's ears, but it's super important to the people who are sharing that story. So we say every story matters. You know, the tougher things, I mean, we do know that, you know, you get into the booth and sometimes you're sharing things that you'd forgotten or that, you know, are very difficult. And often there is emotion that comes up in those conversations. But, you know, our facilitators are there to kind of help guide and to lead folks through. And they take very good care with the participants to kind of follow their mood and to, you know, to handle whatever happens in the booth.
Yeah, it's not, they don't want people to leave the booth having had a negative experience.
No, look, we believe very much our ethos is do no harm. And we are there to make it a safe experience where we are truly honoring someone's story. There was no pressure whatsoever.
Well, you already kind of talked about where some of the recordings end up, Library of Congress, they get aired on, you know, Morning Edition. But, you know, if people want to either check out some of the archive or some of these like produced pieces to maybe check it out, what's the best way to find these things?
Yes, you can go to StoryCorps.org, and there's a whole military voices section. So you can check out the military voices portion and just look at, you know, any of the other stories that are not even part of the initiative that others have shared through the years. And I think that gives you a real window into, you know, what StoryCorps is and how important it is for everyday folks to share their stories.
Yeah. Well, you know, what would you say to somebody who maybe has some stories to tell, but is maybe on the fence or maybe just kind of thinking they're like, you know, maybe these aren't worth anyone else hearing?
Yeah. Well, number one, we would say everyone has a story and everyone's story matters. And if it matters to you and if you want to share it, then we certainly encourage you to sign up. There is no risk in this, you know, and there's no competition in who has the better story. I would say that, you know, we all think we have time and we all think that, you know, maybe we'll do something tomorrow and we don't know. And as I said, in the case of my own parents and my dad, especially, you know, I certainly wish I had a recording of their story now. And so, you know, we don't hit the same cities every year. We're only in three cities this year with Military Voices Initiative. And so this is an opportunity to be able to have a facilitated interview. But the app is always available too for those who don't want facilitated interviews and but still want to share their story.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you'd want to add about StoryCorps, Military Voices Project, anything like that?
Well, we certainly want to thank Alaska Public Media for partnering with us, because we could not do it without our public media partners. And so we're so appreciative of their service, you know, to the community, but also to partnering with StoryCorps.
That was StoryCorps CEO Sandy Clark telling me about their Military Voices Initiative. They'll be in Anchorage July 24th through the 28th for in-person recordings. We'll have links to sign up on the Hometown Alaska webpage. I'm Ammon Swenson, and this is Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. Today, we've been talking about StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, where they gather and archive stories from veterans, active members of the armed forces, or their families. Let's take a listen to another Military Voices piece that was recorded here in Alaska in 2014. This is Carrie and Lynn Seifert.
In 1973, November 5th and 6th, we got married. We had 2 days when we got married. And 3 days after that is when I came in to the Air Force going to boot camp, 3 days after that. And that kind of began our military career. We drove to Alaska. We spent 4 years at Elmendorf Air Force Base. After our 4 years at Elmendorf, I went remote to King Salmon, Alaska. And during that trip, Lynn got to come out to King Salmon for a couple months and live, didn't you?
Yeah, we came out, the kids and I, to live out there.
And you had a lot of experiences out there, homeschooling the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Any other kind of adventures out there that you had?
Dumped the Jeep in the river.
Mm-hmm.
We borrowed this Jeep from this fellow. So one afternoon, I wanted to go fishing, and Carrie was out at the alert cells, and he said, sure, go ahead, and be careful. So we drove the 20-some miles out. What was the name of that lake?
Naknek.
Naknek Lake. So anyway, we get out there, and it's sub-zero. I don't know. It's maybe 5 below, somewhere around there. Really, really cold. And we're out in the middle of nowhere in this drive. I mean, there's nothing between the base and where we're going. Nothing. Zilch. Just wilderness. So as we just started casting, my oldest son turns around, and he goes, Mommy. And I go, what, Nick? And he goes, Mommy, the Jeep's rolling. I'm like, what? He goes, Mommy, the Jeep's rolling. And I turn around, and sure enough, this Jeep is rolling right toward us into the water. So I drop my pole, race up there, fly open the door, and start slamming on the brake. Finally, then I heard him yell, Mommy, jump, jump. And so I jumped out, and there it went, right off the edge of the ice, floated out there, turned a little, and then went glub, glub, glub. Went back to the alert cells where Carrie was at, and took forever to find him, and tried to tell him that the Jeep that we had borrowed was in the Naknek River. And he goes, well, how deep is it? And I said, well, it's deep. Well, how deep? And I said, all the way. It's sunk.
We hooked it to a long winch. The base commander let me use one of the largest winch vehicles they had on the site as a practice rescue.
Big Bertha.
Big Bertha as a practice rescue to pull an aircraft out. And hooked onto it and pulled it up. That's when we put the ramps under the wheels up on the ice and pulled it up.
How deep do you think it was?
Approximately 15 feet.
Probably about 15 feet. I couldn't ask for a better man. He's always been there for me. I'm proud of what he does, his jobs. I'm proud of his military career, that he stuck it out for 20 years, when at that time a lot of people hated Alaska, and they got up here and they did their tour. They left. Most people just didn't like the cold, and he stuck it out, and we made it our home, and
And likewise, I'm most proud of Lynn, because from any Southern California girl to go with some guy the whole rest of her life up to cold country and stick it out with me and raise our kids and our family and then all the foster kids.
It's been awesome.
Yeah, it has.
While listening and sharing veterans' stories can be a way to honor their service, sometimes they need more substantial help, especially if they don't look like what people first think of when picturing a veteran. That's where Operation Mary Louise comes in. We're joined by organization co-lead Vanessa Mead to learn about what they do and how the community can help.
Operation Mary Louise is a women veterans outreach project here in Alaska, and the purpose behind it is to really connect women veterans to the community, resources, and each other.
So how did the organization get started? I'm assuming maybe you saw a need that needed to be met and then kind of went from there. But could you tell me about the origins of the organization?
Sure. Yeah, I started working with veterans back in like 2012. I started an organization called Alaska Veterans Organization for Women. And through that process, we started identifying women veterans' needs. And a couple years ago, Rasmussen Foundation, Diane Kaplan, reached out around offering and creating a community-based way for us to connect with women veterans and also for organizations to come together to really identify women veterans' needs and then work with those things. And so we started meeting, and I became the project coordinator for that. And I work with another person, Penny Chapney, who's a Marine veteran as well. She's out in the valley. And so we started doing Operation Mary Louise, and it's a bunch of different community organizations that work with veterans or have veterans in their population that came together to identify needs and resources and pieces that we could work on to really elevate women vets in Alaska, because we're kind of an invisible population many times throughout the United States, but also here in Alaska. And we have the highest percentage of women veterans per capita, tied with, I think, West Virginia right now.
Wow.
And a lot of people don't even realize that. And just the diversity of women veterans in Alaska, as well as all veterans. A lot of times, you know, veterans are kind of seen as one type of person.
Totally, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so to really be able to work with, how do you ask? Like, example of that is, so often women veterans don't necessarily, and this is shifting and changing because of the number of women veterans now and, you know, our more recent wars and the higher number of women veterans now that happen, how women veterans oftentimes don't even consider themselves to be veterans.
Why is that, do you think, that maybe women wouldn't consider themselves, even though they served, consider themselves veterans?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with kind of the history of what a picture of what a veteran looks like, which is changing. It's changing, you know, especially since women are now serving in all aspects of the military. It used to be we only could serve in certain job occupations in the military, and that's shifted and changed. The number of women veterans who are, you know, women in the military who are serving and who become veterans, that's also the increase. It still amazes me when we're doing outreach and out talking to folks in the community, how often a woman will say, oh, well, you know, I'm not a veteran. I didn't serve in combat, which is, you know, also one of those fallacies, I think, but with male veterans too.
What would you say your role is in the organization? I mean, are you kind of coordinating some of these different groups and stuff like that?
Yeah, so we have monthly meetings online that women can attend to. We have guest speakers and also a way to connect with each other so we can learn things about resources in the community. We've done one conference, the first ever, I believe, Alaska Women Veterans Conference, and it was 2 years ago, and we're holding another one this November on Women Veterans Day in Alaska. And so those are some of the activities, as well as we're doing outreach into the communities. We just had a Veterans Rural Health Advisory Committee, which I serve on for the VA Secretary, and we worked with pulling together some Alaska Native women veterans to talk at that, to specifically address populations of veterans, even within the women veteran community, that maybe their voices aren't heard.
Totally.
So we're really kind of involved in lots of, as well as resources, you know, and referrals. And, you know, if people are needing a certain type of resource, you know, we've got our website, but also, you know, sometimes women will come to the monthly meetings and say, hey, I really, you know, I'm needing this kind of service or help. And we can point them in the right direction for those things as well.
Yeah. How important is that kind of shared background to kind of assist each other? I mean, you know, versus maybe somebody who didn't serve and didn't have to kind of reincorporate into civilian life.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think both are needed. You know, because I think one of the things, peer support is super helpful, but also, you know, the community understanding veterans' issues is really important, too. I work in the School of Social Work at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and Operation Mary Louise is done through Alaska Community Foundation, through the UAA Foundation, and so it comes through the School of Social Work for us to be able to work with this project. And that's one of the things, too, of like having it in institutions and having it instead of it being separate. You know, so oftentimes we kind of put veterans off to the side. Oh, there's veterans issues over here. That
there's
doesn't really affect me.
There's an organization for them. Yeah. They'll deal with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And especially here in Alaska, it's really amazing the number of connections we have with the military and people who have served. And oftentimes I've taught a military and veterans course through UAA, and, you know, I'll have people raise their hands if they served, then have people raise their hands if they know somebody who's served. And by the end of there's maybe one person who doesn't have their hand up.
Yeah.
So, you know, we all have these close connections, but oftentimes we don't really either see them if we're not military ourselves, or we don't know what to say, or we're afraid we're going to say the wrong thing that might upset someone, or those kinds of things. There's a lot of stereotypes around, you know, post-traumatic stress and veterans, and a lot of people have that, and that's not to discount that, but also there's like some different things seen in the media, you know, in movies and stuff about veterans that are just stereotypes that we also need to work with and help people understand, you know, veterans are people, and you know, we all have our things, but that there's also ways to talk about people's experiences in the military that maybe it's really helpful to share with civilians when civilians care enough to ask, not just kind of the rote thank you for your service kind of thing, but to really understand what people have experienced and how that is important in our context as a country, too.
Well, let's kind of shift gears just a touch, but the organization's namesake, Mary Louise Rasmussen, could you maybe talk about her a little bit? Sounds very interesting. I had no idea any of this information about her.
Yeah. So a lot of people know Mary Louise Rasmussen and her work with, you know, Rasmussen Foundation and, you know, as a philanthropist in Alaska. But what people don't realize about her is that she served over 20 years in the military and retired as a colonel before moving to Alaska. And she was the head of the Women's Army. Corps, just this amazing, I mean, groundbreaker, trailblazer for women in the military. She helped set up policy and practices that allowed women to serve in non-traditional roles in the military, to even serve in the military, to get benefits for their service. All of these ways she helped to integrate the military through, you know, working with the Women's Army Corps, with Black women and white women working together. Just this amazing person. And a lot of people don't know that history of her. We know about her in Alaska in a different way, but, you know, she wasn't in the military up here. Of course, I had the opportunity to meet her. She was very humble, too, about her work. But just a trailblazer, not just for women in the military, but for civilian women, too. Many of the things and the policies that were created through the military kind of tends to be a microcosm of our society in ways. And then how that kind of comes over into larger society. She did so much for women being able to work and being in the workforce and just laid the groundwork for many of those things for all women, not just military women.
Yeah. And it just must be kind of like a testament to her character about maybe, I mean, the time period and persevering and all that she did manage to achieve. It's crazy.
I was in basic training at Fort McClellan, Alabama. I was there for military police training straight out of high school. And our drill sergeant, we were one of the only units that were one platoon of females and three platoons of males. At that time, it was the only folks that were cross-training, co-ed training. And our drill sergeant took our platoon of females over to the Women's Army Museum, was there at the time. And there was the pictures of all the directors up on the wall. And I remember seeing her picture. Her maiden name is Milligan. And our drill sergeant literally said, "You're standing on the shoulders of these women. They're the people. They're why we're able to be here." You know, of course, she said, "You know, don't mess it up," because she was a drill sergeant. Yeah. But just to see that history and then to later get to meet her and kind of have this full circle moment of, you know, one of the things that she said to me as we were leaving, she put her hand on my shoulder and she said, "Keep this work up. It's really important." And so, you know, it feels really important to be doing and just an honor to do this work here in Alaska with women veterans, too.
Yeah. Continue the legacy.
Yes.
Well, let's see. So what would you say are some of the biggest issues facing women veterans?
I think there's a lot of things going. We have homelessness is a big issue with women veterans. There's, you know, the VA has made great strides in the services that they're offering for women veterans that, you know, when I get out out of the Army. I won't say what year it was, but it was a while ago, but not that long ago. When I got out, you know, I remember going to a VA and they didn't even have a women's bathroom in the public area. And so, you know, those kinds of things have really shifted and changed, and the services that are being offered for women vets. But we still have a ways to go. You know, we have a lot of younger women vets that are, you know, of childbearing age and having, you know, services for women who are pregnant or who want to become pregnant. Services like childcare at VAs, you know, so that people can go to their appointments. And then there's, you know, the employment issues. Transitioning out of the military is a really difficult thing, whether you've been in, you know, a short time or, you know, you're retiring. It's a huge life change. So I think we can do better, you know, really helping connect women veterans to resources in those critical times, too.
Yeah. And I mean, you've kind of talked about what the general public can do, you know, accepting people into the community and not kind of being judgmental and maybe just kind of treating people like humans. But I mean, in your opinion, what can the general public do for veterans in need? Is it just that like acceptance and kind of community aspect?
I think a lot of times, kind of like what we mentioned earlier around, you know, the thank you for your service stuff, that's really important to hear, but also just listening and asking questions about people's service. And not assuming things, you know, not assuming that people had a great experience in the military, not assuming they had a horrible experience in the military. But just if you really want to connect with people, you know, a lot of times our older generations of people, you know, I think about like of relatives that were World War II veterans and things. A lot of times they didn't even talk about their service many times until they were dying and they, you know, wanted to talk about, you know, what had happened or what they experienced and those kinds of things. And so what we really don't want to, we don't want people to have to wait until, you know, they're, you know, really old or, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that either, but, you know, to be able to be accepted and understand what people have been through and not just kind of putting them in a box of veteran, because there's so many different experiences people have and intersecting identities as a veteran too. I think a lot of times we don't think about those too of, you know, because there's things like racism in the military and, you know, sexual harassment and all of the things that happen in our larger society happen in the military. But in the military, it's a little bit different because, you know, you can't just leave or, you know, not that you can in all situations in civilian world either, but you're in until we used to joke around that, you know, the U.S. Army stood for Uncle Sam ain't released me yet, right? So, you know, you're in. It's not something you can just walk away from. And so, you know, all of the impacts of those types of things are really important, too, to understand that it's not just one type of experience, that, you know, people have good experiences, people have had bad experiences, and a lot of times it's a mixed bag, like everything, right? You know, I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, this project, the StoryCorps project is huge, is that people get to hear people's stories in a way. And also the way they do that with family members as well, or friends, or somebody that maybe hasn't even heard these stories from people. And so how they create that kind of space for people to share what happened for them, or a funny story or sad stories or whatever it is that they feel like sharing. And that's the other piece, too, is being respectful, that sometimes people don't want to, not assuming. Like, it's pretty amazing the things that, you know, people find out I'm a combat veteran. Oh, did you shoot anybody? Like, that's not something you ask people.
Like, first question.
Yeah, you know. Or even any question, right? I mean, that's so, you know, just really thinking about, like, not saying things, too, that one, assume, but two, might be, you know, something that somebody doesn't want to talk about with you. So one of the things we can do is ask, like, is there anything you'd like to share about your experience that, you know, you'd like me to know?
Yeah, and kind of leave it up to them.
Yeah, leave it up to them to decide what to share and not ask really personal pointed questions that maybe aren't so skillful.
Yeah, and then maybe then that person will know that the door is open. So, yeah, okay, I can talk about maybe there are more difficult things to talk about, and then maybe the door is open for a future conversation.
Absolutely. And also, you know, with folks that are transitioning too, I think that's another place that we, you know, because the military is such, I mean, you live it 24/7 when you're in the military, and then all of a sudden you're out. One day you're in and one day you're out. And they do have, they've done better with transition services too, but it's still, it's a real huge change in somebody's life. So if you have somebody in your life that's going through that, just really, you know, reaching out to them and saying, hey, how you doing? That's probably a really difficult thing. Or maybe it's not difficult, but, you know, how are you doing with your transition out of the military?
And remember that everybody's a human being, regardless of if they've served or not. So you can treat them appropriately, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You did mention that you are an Army veteran. We've kind of been talking about, you know, sharing stories and stuff like that. As far as I understand it, you served in the Gulf War. Would you be willing willing to maybe just share a bit of what your service was like or consisted of?
Sure. Yeah. So I was in the U.S. Army. I was a military police officer. I was in for 8 years total, 4 years active duty, almost 4 years active duty, a little short 4 years, and 4 years in the National Guard in Illinois. And I served in Puerto Rico and then a lot of time in the South in my training and different trainings within the military, and then at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and was deployed from Fort Bragg to, which is now called Fort Liberty, or they're changing the name to Fort Liberty, to Saudi Arabia and then into Iraq for the first Gulf War.
Have you found that, and I mean, you don't have to go in too deep into it, but have you found that, you know, sharing your personal stories with, you know, either other veterans or people who never served, did you find some kind of benefit in that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the one great thing about veterans is we all have, even regardless of branch, we kind of give each other a hard time about which branch we served in and things like that. But with other veterans, a lot of times you have a language that's common and you all kind of signed on the line regardless of where you were sent or what you did. So I think with veterans, but also it does really help to have civilians understand too. It helps form policy. I mean, you think about like on the larger level, how military service is connected to so many different things in our world, including, you know, our economy and all of those things as well. And so having people understand what, you know, the military experience is can also influence those things on a larger level too, I think, in ways. And sharing, you know, what has happened in the military for folks.
Well, how can people get in touch with Operation Mary Louise and then stay up to date with what you've got going on?
Yeah. So if you go to OperationMaryLouise.org and you click the Join Us, we're also doing a project right now that we're finishing, which is a visibility project for women vets, where we'll have a website of Alaska women veterans and when they served and their names and stuff for that, so that there is visibility for women veterans here in Alaska. So there's a way that women veterans can submit your photos and information for that, as well as when you join, you fill out in your email and you can get our monthly meeting notices and any newsletters that we send out and anything like that too. And there's also for civilians, you can also join Operation Mary Louise as an ally and learn about things that are happening too.
That was Operation Mary Louise co-lead Vanessa Mead telling me about the Women's Veteran Organization. Let's take a listen to one final Military Voices piece that we recorded in Alaska back in 2014. This is Lucy Artacho and Jason Smith.
We were sitting, I think it was for dinner, and your daughter, who is 3 years old right now, told you that she was going to be a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
She was talking about it the whole way back from gymnastics, too. Yeah, you didn't hear that. She likes to repeat the stories, yeah? She said that you were going to go into the Army and that you were going to be gone and she was going to miss you, but then you were going to come back after a little while. And then after you were back, then she was going to go. And then she would come back, and then her little brother would go, too. And we would all miss each other in this chain of missing each other and coming back.
Yes, so she was referring to the fact that now I am going into the military. I would be going to basic training within a month.
Yeah.
And we have been talking to her about me going to training and me going to miss them, but I will be back. So to a new soldier like me, with all the experience that you had so far, what would you like to tell me?
That's a tough question, hon. I don't know that I would tell you the same thing that I would tell somebody who I wasn't married to. You know, like, I want to protect you more, and I feel like I would want to hold on to you tighter and say don't go, you know, because I wouldn't want to say goodbye to you, you know. But if that's what you want to do, then I support you, because I know it's going to make you happy, and I know that you've had to deal with those same sort of feelings with me, and I think it would kind of be unfair if I told you I didn't want you to go because I was going to worry too much about you. You know, I know that you worried about me, so.
I felt like in the short time that I have, I need to do something useful, and money is not the factor, perhaps, that it was when I was younger. And I start thinking about the military. I like it because it's a regimented lifestyle. It's very active, and those are all things that I like. It's something that I felt I really wanted to do, but I thought it was not compatible with being a mother.
Oh, wow, yeah.
All the time I was thinking, I am going to be old and bitter about never giving it a chance. And now we're in a position where your mom is coming and live with us, and mm-hmm. she's helping with the kids, and you are an absolutely amazing father, and can handle your load and then more. And I want to do it for myself. I'm not sure if I'm doing the right thing. I just know that I cannot not try it. I know that the hardest thing during training is going to be not being with you guys. Mm-hmm. I know I'm going to miss you and our daughter and our son and Nana. And I'm going to be thinking, I'm going to be miserably like somewhere cold eating an MRE and thinking, oh, it's dinner time at home.
I don't think it'll be cold. I think it'll be totally the opposite of here. So
okay, then it would be one less problem.
Really warm.
No, I know I'm going to miss you guys. Mm-hmm. And I'll be looking forward to coming back home.
Yeah, us too.
I love you.
I love you too, honey.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up next, State of Art. Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, we'll hear about a new book from Indra Arriaga Delgado. It's called Opaque Etymologies, 15 Moons, and explores decolonization, identity, and language through art and poetry. But first, walk into the International Gallery of Contemporary Art in downtown Anchorage this month, and you'll be greeted by stacks of colorful journals laid out in a grid on the floor with a writing desk placed in the middle. It's an exhibition from Kenai artist Diane Dunn. Over a year, she made 2,000 journals visitors can interact with by adding their own entry, like a public diary or visitor's book. Dunn says it's a departure from her other work, and she wanted to challenge herself to learn something new. She taught herself bookbinding and monoprinting and wanted to create 2,000 pieces of something.
So printing each cover back and front individually, so there's no two journals the same, and hand cutting all the pages, and then binding each of them by hand.
The project also stems from wanting to start journaling herself. She says she needed an outlet for some difficult things she was experiencing with family and friends, but she found it hard to stay consistent.
So I thought to myself, what if I created a journal that reflected my thoughts, created a piece of artwork, instead of writing something down?
Dunn says her need for an emotional outlet was why she wanted to provide others with a safe place to share their feelings, anonymously if needed. Entries have included fun sketches or notes, but some people have expressed deeper emotions, like one who shared how they overcame suicidal feelings to help others in a similar situation. Dunn says many of the entries have taken her breath away. She reads a few.
There are uncaged ravens at the zoo, and not a feather falls that he does not know. Oh, and this one, again, there's an image of a raven with a berry in its mouth that someone wrote, "This journal reminds me of my Tlingit heritage with all the reds and black and the abstractions of the shapes." Another one is, "My papers of my journals lay bare because I find myself so busy with life and don't invest the time to record moments and memories which I will never forget, that sadly are soon forgotten."
Dunn says after completing the project and seeing all the journals laid out in front of her, she's been able to process the deep angst and negative emotions that spawned it.
I feel good. It feels like I've lifted a huge weight.
You can check out her exhibition, 2000 Journals, Filling the Void, and meet Dunn at the International Gallery of Contemporary Art Thursdays through Sundays from 1 to 4 p.m. through May 26th. Up next, Indra Arriaga Delgado's talents can be difficult to describe. Among other things, she's an artist, writer, filmmaker, and researcher. Originally from Veracruz, Mexico, her new book, Opaque Etymologies, 15 Moons, examines decolonization, identity, and language through art, poetry, and other media. Arriaga says the project required 5 years of work, 3 languages across 2 countries, and the collaboration of more than 30 individuals.
Initially, I was down in Veracruz doing a residency in Intaglio. I had never done Intaglio, so I didn't know that I needed to bring like paper to clean the plate. And so I found an old phone book and I used that to lift the ink from the plate. And then I realized once the ink was on the paper that that was the work, because you had this ink that was representing the contents of the plate itself, which were, you know, a Tower of Babel, a beetle. And then behind the beetle, you know, some telephone wires and then a landscape and the moon. And so that transferred on as an ink blot, you know, with different degrees of density onto these names. And then it, because I was working with the Alaska Native Languages at the time, it gave me the framework so that when I saw that, I was able to recognize the parallels between the loss of language and the loss of family. You know, just traditionally in our indigenous countries where we've been colonized and we've lost ourselves through time.
Yeah. Could you maybe touch on that printing process really quick? Just a little bit about just kind of what that is.
Yeah. So in Intaglio, you use a copper plate and you etch onto it either, you know, through a dry process or a chemical process, an image. And then when you are getting ready to print, you ink the plate with black ink usually. And you don't just do it in the grooves that where you have your image, you do it throughout, right? Because you want to make sure that it's thorough. And then to lift or clean the ink where it doesn't belong on the plate, you do it slowly at first. Like you don't just rub it off. You lift it off. So you put another piece of paper, you press it down, and then you lift it.
Mm.
And that allows for the ink to sink into the grooves, but it also makes it so that you get an evenness throughout the plate.
Mm.
And then from there, you become, you know, more aggressive with the plate and you start like cleaning it off and rubbing off certain parts. But that initial lifting gives you like almost the shadow of what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
Yeah.
So kind of like what you would initially throw away maybe when making something, you decided to keep it. And that was kind of the focus.
And that was the focus, right? Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, the title has 3 translations. So what's the significance of using the 3 translations of the title?
The book throughout is trilingual. It's in English and Spanish and Nahuatl. And Nahuatl is one of Mexico's predominant indigenous languages that has survived for a long time. You know, before colonization, it was like the lingua franca of the region, you know, where you would use it to do commerce with other people, with, you know, the Tonakan people and Mayan people. And so there are records of it being used, you know, from northern Mexico, essentially down to like Nicaragua, right?
Interesting. Yeah. Common language.
It was a common language. You know, it was the equivalent of what English is now, right, in the world. And when the Spanish came, a lot of the language and the culture went, you know, underground and was suppressed.
Have you been studying the language, and has that been kind of a focus of some of your studies?
Yes, but I'm nowhere near knowing the language or being fluent in the language, which is why I had to work with a large group of people to do the translations. And the translations are not, I mean, they're complicated, just like it is with Alaska Native languages. You know, like you just can't translate a word. You have to translate a thought, you know, not just a word. And so things take longer. And it's a beautiful, beautiful process.
So there's also an art installation component to the project. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah. So the art installation consists of the 15 prints. There are the original prints from when I did the lifting of the ink in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of ties everything together. We did the art installation with a presentation about the story of how this project came to be, because it looks like there are a lot of disparate parts, but they actually all go together, right? Mm-hmm. You have the art installation, you have the book, you have the writing, the translations, and then there is a musical element. Because in the translations, the folks that I was working with up in the mountains in Songolica, Veracruz, offered me a song to go with the project. And initially, they offered, you know, like very commercial songs. And it's like, I can't use those. Mm-hmm. I can't do an ABBA song, right? But I can use something that belongs to our culture. And so they did a song called Tetlachiwi in Nahuatl, which means bruja and la bruja in Spanish, which it means the witch in English, but it doesn't really translate to a Western witch. Mm. And it's about an entity that goes out in the night and has engagements with human beings and shows them, you know, the heavens and under the sea and turns them into objects and back again and just shows them all that there is to know and wonder about. But then at the end, there's always a price to pay. And so we did this song as part of the project, and we did it in Songolica in what is not just an old church, but the old church in the region that was established in 1567.
Wow.
And we didn't know we were going to use that church. And when we got there, we did. It was for the first time in my whole life, it was what decolonization felt like.
Hmm. You know? How so?
Because we walked into this church, folks were wearing their traditional clothes, and we did a song in our language that has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. You know, so it was taking back that space that for, you know, centuries has been used to suppress. It was an amazing experience.
No, tell me about the music a little bit more, because I think I saw, are these the ones that are posted on your website that you can listen to?
Yeah. Yes.
So were you involved in the recording? How did the recording and all that work out?
Yeah. So I didn't know that we were going to, you know, record it. So I went, my friend JW came with me, and we had one computer, one microphone. And when I got home, I thought I was going to record just one of the teachers who was helping me with the translations. And then she said, oh, well, there's might be like two or three of us. I'm like, okay. And then she said, oh, no, there's actually 11 of us. And so then at that point, everything changed. And then we had to like pack everything up and go up to the mountains instead of having them come down. Uh-huh. And so that's when we recorded in the church. And then there are two versions of it, of the same song with the same arrangement. One is in Spanish, which is sung by my cousin Marisol. And then the other one is in Nahuatl, which is sung by the choir.
Yeah. I mean, what was it like even just sitting there? I mean, you know, you mentioned the kind of decolonization feeling, but even maybe just like musically, emotionally, how was it sitting in that church listening to that get recorded or performed?
Well, you know, it was amazing. So the song itself originated in the southern part of the state of Veracruz, you know, near the water, in Songolica, is in the mountains. And there are different variations of son jarocho, which is what it is, depending on which area of the state you're in. Like, right, like different elements come in, like the violin comes in at one point, you know, the harp comes in at another point. And so it was amazing to be there and just feel the voices kind of just wash over you. But then we had to take that and we had to add the other elements from the other parts of the state. Mm. So the harp was recorded separately. You know, the jarana and requinto were recorded separately. So it was really like a synthesis that had to happen after in post-production.
How can people get their hands on the book, too, if they are interested? I know there's limited amount of copies.
Yeah, so we can only afford to print 300 copies. And, you know, it's a hardcover book, and it's a beautifully designed book. The cover unfolds into a giant print, and it was just done with so much care. I only have 70 copies available in Alaska, because that's just the way it worked out with, you know, giving some in Mexico and, you know, the communities, and then some are going to libraries. So I'm just going to put that on the website, and people are welcome to like just contact me and buy one if they want.
And that's all for Hometown Alaska. Special thanks to Sandy Clark of StoryCorps and Vanessa Mead of Operation Mary Louise. Hometown Alaska is produced by me, Ammon Swenson. You can find us on the Hometown Alaska page on alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.